Okay. The following interview was conducted with Bob Dymer on behalf of the SIU Oral History Project. It took place on Tuesday, June 11th at the Regional Education Office in Edwardsville, Illinois. And the interviewer is Kelly Barber. So, welcome, Bob Dymer.
Thank you.
So, Bob, if we could start off, if you could describe how growing up in Marine, Illinois influenced your life.
Okay. I guess the way that it probably most influenced my life is that it was so local, okay? And you grew up really in a time that's different than today in that I always, when people talk to me about growing up in Marine, it could almost be like a story because you grew up walking around places. You grew up on the street, really, was how you grew up in neighborhoods with a lot of different kids that you played with every day. You know, I grew up in the 1960s, and that was before people even watched TV all day long. You only watched TV when you watched particular programs that were on, and it wasn't like you had, you know, TV during the day was, I think, soap operas, and, you know, it wasn't like kids shows. I mean, cartoons were only on Saturday morning, and there was after-school programs and things like that. So during the day, you know, most of us played outside. Ball games were like all day long, like from 11 o'clock until probably dark. And bicycles were the main thing because everybody rode their bike everywhere. And as you got older, you know, you were more responsible, so your distance that you could ride your bike was further around town. And so that was what life was like growing up. And, you know, you were, I think the thing is that growing up in Marine, it was a safe community. But, you know, you were asked as a young person to, you know, the responsibility. Like, I always walked to school from the time I was 4 years old until, you know, I graduated from high school when I'd come home on activity buses late at night. I mean, it was just different then. Parents didn't take you to school. I mean, I walked to school every day with my boyhood friends and walked home from school and did the same thing through high school. We activity bus drop you off. No one picked you up. So in saying that, what I really mean is that you were part of the community. People saw you around. Everybody knew whose kids everybody was. I think one of the big things going to Marine grade school was very wholesome because there was a lot of pride in the community. I played sports and was known for that in the community, and it helped shape my personality with people and how younger kids looked at me and how I was inspired by older kids. And also when I was growing up in Marine, there was an Army base there. And a lot of people don't know that today, but right on the northwest part of Marine, there was a missile base, in fact, there. So in the community, the other thing is, you know, I used to see these young soldiers that would come into town. They walk around town. I had older sisters, so they naturally were there. They visited my sisters. And so my mom and dad would have them there a lot of times for dinner because they felt sorry for these guys. So there was another dimension that, you know, I learned about the military very young growing up, and it was in a time of when we had the military draft, in fact. So, but Marine, it taught me a lot because it was a working class community as I look back on it. And I guess the one thing that was most inspirational about it was that most people that lived in Marine were not college educated, okay? And other than unless you were like a teacher, my mom and dad, my dad especially, was very pro going to college. I mean, he didn't get to go because of the Depression, and his goal was that all of his kids would graduate from college, which they did. And and you know, it was like living the American dream, and everybody wanted better for, you know, this generation that I was growing up in. But there were also, you know, like real fundamental values, I think, that shaped my life there. And part of them was you know, we had a church community that we were part of and you know, participated in it, and you knew people from there. And the community as a whole was a big neighborhood, I want to say. And everybody knew each other, you know. But, you know, I had aspirations, and a lot of it came from, you know, my education that I got when I was in grade school and then went on to high school, and how that began to shape what you were going to do and what your abilities were. And I never did really plan to be a teacher, for example. It was just that, you know, I was a good shop kid when I was in high school, and I was inspired by Mr. Yakos, who was a teacher, and that was kind of a roundabout way. But I, in answering the question, I think just a lot of the values that were there in the community made people who lived there who they are, about what they valued, what they respected, what, you know, how they keep their property today. You know what I mean? Because it was an expectation, you know what I mean, of the type of person you were supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So.
Hmm. Okay. Okay. So you did become an educator, a teacher in the classroom. So with all of your years in public education, what were some of the greatest changes in education that you've experienced over the years?
Well, this reveals my age a little bit, but you have to realize there were no computers, okay?
Yeah.
Pocket calculators were really just becoming the big challenge when I started to teach in 1980. In fact, I remember teachers who didn't know if it was a good idea for kids to use calculators as to how well their math skills would be. Like, if they used a calculator, could they really do the times tables? If they used a calculator, did they really understand percentages and fractions? And then, you know, so typewriters and then self-correcting typewriters. I mean, I go down this whole technical lineage of things that I remember. But prior to the computer age, okay? And with the advent of, in 1983, I was teaching, it was my third year of teaching. There was this big thing that happened in the United States. It was called the Nation at Risk Study. And I remember it because very well, I'd went back and taken some graduate classes, and so we were learning about what was being said, and the Nation at Risk study began to change things big time in education, along with the advent of the computers, okay? And the reason I use the two is the Nation at Risk study said that we were falling behind other countries and that there was no data accountability in what was going on in the United States in learning, okay? So you had the data-driven part of education coming from that. And you also have this other technological revolution that's going to take place electronically in education. So probably the greatest thing that I saw happen was when the first computers, the Apple IIe's, came out. And I bought the first one that was in the Triad District. And I remember having discussions of, I bought it through a grant, yeah, about whether or not this was good or bad for education as to what was going to happen with this, okay? So little by little, the story be told, computers became, you know, we started having computer labs and the changes in which kids were going to learn and how we did tutorials. And then also, you know, the technical applications of those computers as to all the different things they could do in business applications as well as word processing. So that was a major change in education. And then in the 1990s, with the advent of the internet, okay, came about, was this whole new, you know, dimension. I remember I wrote and got one of the first online grants to help the Triad District go online. I remember what was said to me by the principal at the time there, and that the principal said, I'm going to go along with this, but I don't think you know what you're doing, that you're going to expose these kids to this whole world, you know. And today I couldn't imagine a school not having the internet, you know what I mean, or no school could function without it. Right. But these things were all questioned because they were new, and it was risky because of, you know, outside of the world communication. It was opening our doors to everybody. But and then, you know, this whole thing with mobile learning, tablets, I think, has been, you know, the one-for-one initiatives that we've seen in schools as to how kids learn. Those technological developments have have all been major that I've watched unravel. But you know, something that I think far beyond that I've seen is I've seen a change in maybe the dynamics of teachers. Okay, and that you know, subject matter wise, you know, I think the way teachers teach has changed because of the technology. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know, that also had to do something with what I call the art of teaching. You know, teachers before they had all the technology, to be really good, had to be somewhat of an actor. There had to be an art to it to hold. I mean, so, you know, when people think about, or they would say something about, oh, this guy was a really good teacher, they really were talking about, you know, because, you know, well, why did you like him? Well, because he did this, or this lady did this, or what. And today, you know, teachers in many cases that are in the classroom are more facilitators, because they're mm-hmm. facilitating learning. So what I'm describing is really a change in teaching dynamics that I've observed. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that every really good teacher has got to have an act in the classroom. Mm-hmm. There's got to be something that's the attention getter that gets kids' attention, no matter how much technology we have. The other thing is that I think I've seen in education happen is that there's been a request, and I think schools have delivered it, and it's a greater level of accountability. Okay, when I started to teach, there was no accountability. I mean, it was like freedom, and I laugh about it because there. You know, today we have peer evaluations, and you were evaluated, but it wasn't on benchmarks or by gain scores, and that's why I mentioned the Nation at Risk, because it brought about looking at, you know, data, okay? So there was, you know, how well someone did, some of it was observation, okay? And today I think we're more analytical, okay, as to how things happen. I might also just say something about just the nature of our schools, okay? And I don't know if it's all good, but I see our facilities resembling more as to what maybe higher education was today and not what high school was meant to be, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, like everybody tries to have the better facility, okay? Mm-hmm. And our goals, you know what I mean? Like we have very high-level sports complexes. I'm going to use that as an example. Mm-hmm. And they attract residents because they're awed by them. You know, they're not what they were in the 60s, 70s, or even 80s, or even 90s. I mean, what you see today. Sure. I mean, these are state-of-the-art complexes. And our schools, you know. I taught 20 years in a non-air-conditioned environment with no phone. There was one phone line, and this sounds absolutely crazy, but there was one phone line and a pay phone that you had. I even taught before there was call cards, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, today, you know, like I'm sitting here with two cell phones and a phone on my, a landline on my desk. And I just think about that sometimes. And I actually laugh about the first time when I was working on a textbook series in the late 80s. And I think about taking these calls at the secretary's desk on, because there's only one line. You know, it just was, you know, it's just different. The expectations of what you need to have today and the environment in which you work, in which no one thinks about sending their kid to school in a non-air-conditioned environment. No one thinks about not being able to email a teacher if they got a question, mm-hmm. or being able to make a phone call. I mean, so these are just facility changes. You know, the other thing is that I've seen, and being a regional superintendent, I'm the guy that has to sign the documentation on it. But, you know, school lunch has changed because, really? You know, like, up until like mid-1990s, there was no breakfast programs. Hmm. I mean, you either ate before you came to school for breakfast or you didn't have anything. You know what I mean? So breakfast, lunch was served, but there was no school breakfast. And studies showed that, you know, kids that, you know, eat before they begin to learn better because they're not hungry and their attention spans better, which I agree with. But that was a major change to see breakfast being served and lunch being served because, you know, I remember going to grade school, sack lunch days. I mean, we always had a hot lunch, but 50% of the kids probably brought their lunch. Yeah. You know, I mean, a sack. I mean, it was just the way it was, you know. But, you know, for all in all, if I had, is education much better, much richer today than when I started in 1980? Definitely. Mm-hmm. Would anybody go back? No. No one would want to go back to, you know, one thing that I missed was Xerox, talking about Xerox, because I started teaching with mimeograph machines, mm-hmm. and you had these blue duplicator masters in this mm-hmm. ink, and especially when you started school in August, it was hot, you know, so you normally came home and you were purple. You know, because you sweated,
yeah.
and you'd be making copies for the next day, and you'd be assembling them. So you had this purple and this smell. You know, there was the olfactory part of the job too. And I remember when we got the first Xerox machine about what you were allowed to use it for and what you were not, because we still were on purple Ditto masters. Mm-hmm. And you know, just how you saved information in file folders to make masters, as opposed today, what you're saving in your folders on your computer,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, if I went back in the classroom today, so much of the way that I would teach would be electronic, paperless.
Right.
So, you know, and, you know, like today, I operate a computer-based testing center for certifications. And, you know, things like that were unheard of. I mean, I've seen GED go from paper to paperless in this job. So
wow.
those are the transformations that I've seen in education over my career. Yeah, yeah, I look back on it. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. It's really amazing where we've came from.
Yeah.
But the one thing is consistent that hasn't changed is that every kid that comes into school wants someone to like him and wants the teachers to like him.
Yeah, that's true. Even though they may act like they don't, they
yeah,
really do. Right?
Every kid wants to feel included, and every kid wants to be liked.
Yeah.
I mean, so
that's true. That's a good point.
That's
a great point.
Yeah.
So why did you decide to leave the classroom and enter the regional education office that you're in now?
Well, it was difficult. I was torn at the time when I became regional superintendent. I also was in the second term of being on the Madison County Board. I was in government, okay, here. And I had an office on the second floor here in planning and development. I chaired planning and development, which oversees like all the development in the county, construction development, residential, commercial, mm-hmm. business. And it was a very busy time. It was there from 2002 to 2006 when the building boom was going on.
Mm.
And there was a lot going on in Madison County. I'll just be honest with you. We were looking at building roads and bridges, and I was involved in all this. I was highly interested in it. It was luring my attention. I also was very involved in education at the time in Triad because I was wearing many different hats. I think at the time I was president of the IEA there. I was a department head. I was coordinating what was called tech prep. I was teaching full time. And so I was like really busy. Okay. So my life had gotten so busy and I was torn between two worlds that I really loved. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the regional superintendent, Harry Briggs, decides he's going to resign. He's going to go back and become a district superintendent. And I was on the county executive committee at the time, and the members of the county executive committee seriously talked to me. They told me, they said, look, you should do this. You really should do this. And the discussion happened, really the deal breaker happened one morning at about 7:15. We used to have 7 o'clock highway department meetings. And it was always tough for me because I'd do those 7 o'clock meetings and I never did want to stay because for coffee and donuts because I had an 8 o'clock class. So
oh, wow.
I'd have someone covering for me till I got there at 8 o'clock, you know, and they all knew I needed to get to school. So, but that, on that particular morning, Frank Lobb said to me, he goes, "Hey, don't run off. I want to talk to you." So Frank's like, "You know, I'm going to be very honest with you." He goes, "You're a fool if you don't take this, because you're the right person. You'd do a great job. It would simplify your life, you know," and he went on with all this, and "you're really needed in the county." And he said, it would be a great professional move for you. So, but it was so hard to leave Triad because I'd been there 28 years. Yeah. You know, like I went to school there 12 years. So like 40 years of my life has been at this place that's on the wall that I look at every day here at a picture. And it was just like, I had a hard time imagining giving my keys up. Like, I had the biggest ring of keys of anybody because of Tech Ed. I mean, because we had all these locks, and I had like keys to about everything there. I was just like, wow, you know, and I just, you know, helped, you know, design that part of the, it was a new school at the time, you know.
That's right, yeah.
And it was so nice, and I just always dreamed of working like what we've talked about, you know, in such an environment. I was going to leave there to come to uncertainty. You know what I mean? I mean, and leave a place where everybody liked you to come to a place where maybe not everybody likes you. But I looked at it as professional growth. I looked at it as a new challenge in my career, and I looked at it as a place where I could make a bigger difference. So, you know, over there, you know, we talked about with my family. Also, it's an elected position, so, you know, it wasn't secure. I mean, and I was going to have to run in 2 years to get reelected. Well, the story be told, you know, I served in this office for 10 years, and a lot of good things have happened, and it was the right decision because I've impacted a lot more kids, I think, than if I'd stayed being a teacher, and have brought some very positive things to education in this region. So, but you know, probably reminiscing, I'm most proud that I'm a teacher. And that's why I still teach. I teach at the alternative school.
Oh.
Still go there and have fun.
Wow.
And teach units every year. I've taught every year that I've been a regional superintendent there.
Hmm.
And kids, probably the greatest reward that I get is as kids say to me, "How come don't you just teach?" You know? And I drive back and I think about it. So, you know, I don't say that I won't ever be a teacher again. But that was how I made the decision, and I think it was the right one.
Hmm. Wow. Okay.
I didn't make it for money. In fact, I'll tell you a secret in this interview. I actually made less when I became regional superintendent than when I was a teacher at Triad the first year. Yeah,
wow.
I made less because I gave up my county board salary.
Oh, okay.
So that was how I made less.
Right.
In fact, Ken Miller, who's the business manager.
So you had to give up the county board position
because
this was another
This was another county elected office.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
So,
huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
Huh. Okay. So tell me about your other political experience prior or to leading up to being the regional superintendent and now the next step that you're going into.
Well, you know, when I was teaching at Triad, I had run for the legislature unsuccessfully. And I had an interest when I did those legislative runs that I wanted to reform the way schools were funded, because property taxes was, people just complain, and they still complain about property taxes.
Sure.
Okay. So I was on this mission that I wanted to get elected to the legislature to introduce legislation to try to reform the way schools were funded. That was my mission. I also saw, you know, things that I thought I could help bring about in state government that would be good, but I was unsuccessful. So from that, I became a village trustee in Marine. I decided I'd serve on the village board. I was encouraged to do so. It was an open seat. So I did that, and it was good. And today I look around, I drive around Marine, and local government is really doing service for people. So when I look at the pavilion in Marine in the park that I engineered and saw it built, go to Pocahontas Road, and I look at how much better that entrance is there because it was falling apart, and I took it on and redid it. I looked on Lubeck Reach, which is a drainage problem that was there, and I corrected it. I look at the Marine Heritage Park, the lake there. I began that. Wow. So, and then I look at the equipment that's still there that I bought and purchased. And I did all this in 4 years' time. And so I saw a real dedication that I had done in community service there as a trustee. And I was going to run for another term, and Don Goodall, who was the township supervisor, came to me, and he goes, you know, people talk about you. I mean, you ought to think about, he goes, I want out of being supervisor, and I'd like for you to take it over. So I said, well, I'd think about it. So it meant I left the village board. I became the township supervisor, which I did, and which was really administrative. And being a township supervisor is, if you do it right, is really an involved job because you deal with general assistance. And it's probably taught me a lot about people in need, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I have, you know, I'm still proud because I'm still township supervisor, although I'm regional superintendent. But I have a policy because of kids that go to school every day, is that every kid that lives in my jurisdiction has running water, has electricity, and has the amenities they need to live. Okay, so we don't often think about it, but we have people living without electricity. We have people who get their water shut off. So there's water shut off. How does that kid take a shower or a bath the next day? Mm-hmm. You know, there's no electricity. How do they go home and do homework or use, you know, if they have a computer, how they use it?
Yeah.
You know, so those are some things that I've felt very good that I've provided through general assistance and. Also, just helping do the general maintenance in that area. So that I've done for, I'm in my fourth term and final term of that office. I'm not running again. So I'll have served 20 years after this term is up as township supervisor. And but I've learned a lot about it in financial management, budgets, levies, and all those types of things. So. And as I mentioned, when I was on the township supervisor, I also was on the county board. And the county board experience, I will tell you, probably if there's anything that I ever reach back upon for knowledge, it taught me so much about government, about being part of a legislative body and how you get along with people that you are serving with and how you support them. And it taught me so much about Madison County. Because I lived on one side of the county, and Madison County is diverse. Yeah. I mean, the west side of the county is altogether different than the east side of the county in demographics in so many ways and in needs, because the river borders Madison County. Mm-hmm. So if you live out where I live in Marine or Highland or St. Jacob, I mean, you don't think about the river every day. If you live in Granite City, you think about the river every day because you think about flooding, mm-hmm. okay? And you also think about the just what that river does. And the other thing in Madison County and serving on the county board that, you know, it's rural on the east side and it's heavy industry on the west side. Mm-hmm. So there's different needs, okay? Your communities are different. Your bigger cities are on the west side. Your more rural, you know, neighborhood communities are on the east side. Mm-hmm. So I learned all about this and got to be friends with people, and they saw me as a supportive person. And got involved in really some big scale development with the Gateway Commerce Center. And I got really involved with Governor's Parkway, something I'm really proud of that I was part of. And at the very end of the time I was on the county board, the America Central Port was starting to be considered. We took over the old Army Depot in near Grant City. And that whole development began taking place there at the Port District. And then the last thing that I was involved with on the county board was the new Mississippi River Bridge project, because I was on the highway department. And we had to exchange so many acres of, we had to acquire wetland areas in the Oka River Valley in order for that bridge to be built, which taught me, you know, a lot about environmental controls. And my main role that I did as chair of a committee, you know, as I drive around the county, I see a lot of these subdivisions that I signed off on. So I oversaw planning and development, so I signed all the preliminary plots, final plots on these subdivisions, and you saw vacant land that then became now it's a residential subdivision, and so, you know, it was a great experience before becoming a regional superintendent. But being a regional superintendent and being one of the countywide elected officials in this building is special. I mean, it's a unique privilege. I mean, because you deal with all the other units of government. I mean, we've worked together to make Madison County what it is. Okay, people blame you for what it is, so you take credit for what it is too. And it's been an experience that, you know, there's only so many people have it because there's only a few of us that have the privilege. And being elected to a countywide office like this is a privilege because there's only a few of you that ever get the opportunity in a lifetime. I mean,
that's right.
So, you know, I decided, in being regional superintendent, I was elected to become the president of all the regional superintendents in 2010. So I served a four-year term in which I was president statewide. And that was an honor. It was a difficult time. We were challenged with numerous things legislatively, including we weren't paid for 6 months. And but it developed a personality that I think people knew about me in Springfield because I was there so much. And and I learned a lot during that time, just about the state and about education throughout the state, which really began to set a stage for, you know, this next endeavor that I'll talk a little bit about, and that's running for governor, okay? Mm-hmm. Because, Illinois is a big state, it's a wealthy state, and it's broke. And our school system, you know, there's so much discussion about how do we fund public education in Illinois, mm-hmm. how do we move education forward, why is it last in the 50 states as to how it's funded? And so I decided after 2014 when I really saw what was materializing that this is something that I thought that a person from another part of the state outside of Cook County should become a candidate. There should be a downstate candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I began exploring it, and I will tell you I'm in the middle of this exploratory phase of my candidacy. We're about 2 months from circulating petitions. In which when we actually begin circulating those petitions, it really starts becoming really reality that you're going to be a candidate, not just, there are six of us that are recognized statewide as viable candidates right now, and I'm very mm-hmm. proud that I have gotten the invitations, especially the last 2 months, to be involved as a candidate that's being looked at to get this nomination. And as I've talked about many other things that I've done in my professional career, it's a real growth dimension. It challenges me in every way possible. My speaking abilities, my ability to message, my ability to manage, my ability to be creative in ideas and in thought, my ability to, you know, deal with people and be competitive, have good personal presentation. Mm-hmm. So. But it's a great experience, and win or lose, we go back to the very first question. You know, it's about growing up in a Marine. I think the thing is that about me is tomorrow I can go Marine, put on my jeans and T-shirt, be just like I was when I was six. So that's the unique thing about it, you know.
Yeah, that's a good thing to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
So since you led into the governorship, so
right.
Why did you decide to run for this? I mean, that is the top position.
Yep.
And
yep.
Is it because you just want to further make a difference across the state? And
well, I think my background is so diverse. And my background in local government was really the reason I decided to do it. It's about making a difference. But more than that, The big difference that the next governor is going to make is whether or not they can bring about stability to the state,
mm-hmm.
whether they can balance the budget, whether they get the state back on track, okay, whether they're willing to really make hard decisions, okay, you know, whether they can come up with a creative plan to solidify the pension dilemma that we have, whether they can curtail the runaway cost of Medicaid in the state, which is consuming 42% of our budget. You know, how do we make this state better? And understanding what Illinois has to offer, something I haven't talked about is that I have my lifelong background is in agriculture, and it's the biggest business in the state. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just having a working knowledge of agriculture, I think, is a huge asset to someone who's the chief executive of an agricultural state on harmful legislation or helpful legislation that becomes law. Mm-hmm. You know, I think also, you know, I've got 38 years in public education. And, you know, it's one thing to, you know, be advised about education. It's something else to have dealt with school budgets, dealt with school administrations, understand how school boards operate, understand the impact that schools have on their communities economically, okay, mm-hmm. and understand teachers and understand, you know, I explained that I was president of Tri's Education Association with the IEA. You know, why should teachers be able to collectively bargain? You know, understanding. And so I feel that my ability to govern comes from the diverse experiences that I've had throughout my life, okay? And that I can lead in those capacities. So this really wasn't an R about, you know, something that, you know, I woke up one day, I said, hey, you know, I think it would be great if I died and they could say I was governor. My goal is to be able to make a difference and, you know, bring about a change that I think is needed in the image of the state. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm running.
Okay. Well, you kind of answered what my next question was going to be. What are your strengths? But like you said, with agriculture, I think obviously right. that's an enormous strength.
Yeah, I think a strength that a lot of people, you know, don't always look at is the amount of time a person has spent in government, understanding mm-hmm. it. You know, I said something about understanding, you know, like when you serve on a county board, you realize you don't always get everything you want. Okay, mm-hmm. that's a strength. Yeah. You have to understand government, that you have to be able to accept success and failure. I mean, because both happen. And so those are unique strengths. So, and some people have a hard time. You know, when you look at any administration locally, at the state level, at the national level, you know, the big debates over big issues. You know, mm-hmm. the compromise that happens and those people that didn't want to compromise. And that's government. That's what it's about. That's government. And that's how policy is shaped for people. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So as bad as Illinois is, as everyone knows and the media yeah. certainly
sure.
plays on, I mean, how do you fix such a broken state? I mean, that's got to be such a huge
right. Here's the beginning. First of all, it didn't get this way overnight, mm-hmm. and it's not going to get better tomorrow.
Right.
Okay? But it's got to begin somewhere. So if you don't have a plan, then you probably shouldn't be, you know what I mean, willing to step up and do this. And I have a plan. And mm-hmm. that plan is, first of all, you have to develop a manageable budget. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's where it starts. Okay? Right. And a manageable budget gives you a better bond rating, okay? And you begin to pay your debt down. The Senate Bill 6 that passed was good, okay? Because it is a plan, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's why I supported it. Illinois needs revenue. You know, a lot of people are really touting against this tax increase. We have $15 billion of unpaid bills, backlogs of bills, so the crisis is not over because this has happened.
Sure.
But people in Illinois are paying $11 million a day in interest. That's just wasting money away. So my plan is to pay down the debt, reduce the interest, improve the bond rating, stabilize the state, then be able to move forward. And you have to allow in your manageable budget, you know, debt interest, and you have to allow principal payments, and you've the key thing is that all these different aspects that consume a $36 billion budget, you have to be thinking about, you know, how you're going to make that pension payment, okay? Or what could have been done that would have relaxed that pension payment, you know? Because, you know, myself and every other teacher, every other state worker that has paid into the system or that has, you know, dedicated themselves as a professional, part of the reason why was because at the end, there was supposed to be something for them, mm-hmm. okay? Right. So I don't think it's fair that, you know, we pass policy in this state that, you know, lies to people who did what they said they were going to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. So do you consider yourself an underdog going into this primary?
Well, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, being from downstate, there's a whole lot of introduction that's got to be made. You know, the Cook County area is about 3/5 of the total vote of the state.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of introduction that you have to make. Okay. But I have great name recognition in this region. Okay, which is the second right. largest populated area of the state. I think this region will really determine who's going to be the gubernatorial candidate for the Democratic Party. Things are going well for me in Chicago. So, you know, I'm not going to say I'm an underdog till I see how far I'm down in the polls.
Yeah.
So sure. I have a lot less financial resources. I mean, there's people in this race. Most of us aren't too far apart, plus or minus a couple $100,000. But, you know, when you have a candidate that's got just unlimited financial resources,
right?
What does that do? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
And plus the name recognition.
Right.
As
plus
well.
Name plus name recognition. Yeah. So that makes a challenge, you know. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that that's what happens on election day.
Sure. Right.
So.
Yeah.
And it's a long way out yet. It's 7 months. So there's a lot that can happen.
Yeah.
And money can be good and money can be bad.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he'll be the change that the state needs.
We'll just see. We'll just see.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Oh, you bet.
This has been a great interview, I think. And I think a wealth of information, too, that
okay.
is going to benefit the county.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I really appreciate. In fact, I'm going to send an email out Monday. You'll get one. We're going to have a meeting here August 4th of everybody that's participating in the cohort.